The Secrets of Doctor Who is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give.
You're listening to The Secrets of Doctor Who, where we discuss everything about the hit BBC series Doctor Who. And today we're discussing another Big Finish audio story, The Rapture, featuring the Seventh Doctor. I'm Dom Bettinelli, and joining me today on the panel are Jimmy Akin. Hey, Jimmy.
Howdy, Dom.
And Father Corey Stika. Hey, Father Corey.
How's it going?
Folks, remember to like The Secrets of Doctor Who on our Facebook page, facebook.com/secretsofdoctorwho. Retweet us on X, where we're at SQPN. And be sure to leave us comments wherever you find us online. We love to hear from you. And that means we've got listener feedback that we've received from people that we're going to share at the end of the show. So stick around for that. And finally, another podcast on the StarQuest Network you're sure to enjoy is PrayStation Portable. It's Lent as we record this, and this is a great opportunity to start praying every day using the Divine Office of the Catholic Church. And so check it out, PrayStation Portable, wherever fine podcasts are found, or at sqpn.com/PSP. All right, so this time we are talking about the Rapture, which is an interesting theological concept. We'll get into that. But first, Jimmy, can you give us a recap of what happens in the story?
This week, the Seventh Doctor and Ace show up on the Spanish island of Ibiza in 1997, where young people go to drink alcohol, take drugs, have sex, and dance at clubs. The most popular club is a religiously themed one called The Rapture, and we get a lot of religiously themed weak writing trying to make it sound all creepy and mind-control-y. Eventually, it is revealed that the two ostensible angels who run the club, Gabriel and Jude, are actually aliens. Big surprise. They're from a peaceful race in another dimension that was invaded, and Gabriel, a peaceful man who was a composer, was drafted but was not suited for war. The strain drove him insane, and he killed a superior officer. His brother, Jude, brought him to Ibiza and convinced him he was an angel in an attempt to help him find some peace. But Jude is planning to use his brother's music at the dance club to recruit a mind-controlled army of young humans to help in their war effort, hoping that their leaders will forgive him and Gabriel and get Gabriel the help that he needs. However, Gabriel falls from the DJ booth in the club and dies, and Jude decides to kill everybody using his brother's music. But the doctor plays a recording of Gabriel talking about his brother, and it restores enough of Jude's compassion to get him to back down. The end.
There's a lot of details in there that didn't need to be added, that you didn't include, which is good, because there's a lot of wandering around in this one. But
I didn't even mention Ace's brother that we meet for the first and only time in this.
I know. There's a lot going on. But before I give my rest of my impression, Father Corey, what's your impression of this one?
I kind of enjoyed this. I mean, the music obviously added the atmosphere that was needed, including remixing the theme. You know, in more of a techno style, which I kind of enjoyed, you know, that's kind of a guilty pleasures 90s style techno every once in a while. So
I did like the Doctor Who theme disco club remix. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was kind of a nice added flavor to it. And, you know, getting to know a little bit more about Ace's background, of course, is always a good thing. As we will talk about, the Doctor's theology is, he definitely doesn't know everything because he doesn't know what the Rapture is really about. So we'll leave it at that. But it was all right. It was all right. There was one scene though that I use my headphones like I do when I'm recording, when I'm listening, and it was actually kind of painful because it was supposed to be a trip basically. Mm-hmm. So,
okay. Anything else? I'm sorry, I didn't.
No, that's it. That's it.
Okay, Jimmy, your impression of this one?
Yeah, I set out hating this one because what it does is it takes the Christian religious iconography and try to make it seem creepy and mind controlling approach, and I always hate stories that do that. And they're just inevitably poorly written and off putting. And the people who write them, you know, aren't informed enough to use the source material in a credible way. This one's a little bit better in that regard than it could have been. But I set out, I was not going to give this one a glowing review under any circumstances. The question is how bad it was going to be. And it's not as bad as it could have been. For two reasons. The first two parts of this is a four-parter. Each part is like 25 minutes, 30 minutes long. And part one is pretty boring. Part two gets a little more interesting because it has quick cutting between conversations. Mm-hmm. There are like several different conversations, and we're rapid cutting between the different conversations. In cinema, these would be called cuts on action. It's a little where, like, you know, you see like a classic cut on action is in 2001, A Space Odyssey, where the ape throws the bone into the air. And then all of a sudden we cut on, here's a spaceship that's looks like the bone. And so we've transitioned visually from one thing to something else that looks mm-hmm. like it in a similar motion. In audio, in a conversation, the way that works is you have one person leading up to the end of a sentence, and they either say the final words of the sentence or they're about to, and you know what the final words are going to be. And then we cut to someone else having a conversation where they're using those same words. So like if I was talking about, you know, oh, I'd really love some apple pie. And then we cut to a chef saying, apple pie is a very easy thing to bake. You know, that would be an audio cut on action. And we have a lot of that going on in part two. In part three, we get a discussion between Jude, the sane, if we can use that word, the sane alien, and Ace's brother Liam, who is a Christian. And we get an actually serious critique from Jude of the difference between prior generations that like fought World War II and the sort of wastrel generation that is around in 1997, where they don't have a big enemy to fight and they don't have a firm belief in God. And so they end up just spending their lives on nothing, on drugs and sex and music and alcohol, and they're wasting their lives. They're wastrels. They don't use that word here, but you know, that's the message. And because they don't have a larger meaning, a larger purpose in their life, either in terms of God who they would worship, or in terms of having an enemy like the Nazis to fight. And in the absence of a real enemy to fight, they turn into their own enemies, and they end up just spinning their wheels, and they have depression and schizophrenia and mental problems, and it's all a product of their lack of focus. And okay, not entirely psychologically accurate there, but there's substantial truth here. And I was pleased that the writer of this, who I'm not favorably disposed to, was willing to make that critique. We also, mm-hmm. I like that we have Liam as a sincere church-going Christian. He goes to church every week, mm-hmm. and he's also a geek. He likes the X-Files because it's the 90s, and he likes Professor X, which is Doctor Who, the TV show Doctor Who in the Doctor Who universe, mm-hmm. is about a time traveler called Professor X.
Oh.
Which, of course, spins off from the revelation of the Remembrance of the Daleks with the Seventh Doctor and Ace.
Yeah.
Because she turns on the TV and she walks out before it warms up, and this new science fiction show,
Yep.
Yeah. You know,
it goes from there. It's set in 1963, so it's meant to lead into the broadcast of Doctor Who, except it can't be Doctor Who in the Doctor Who universe, so it's Professor right. X. So part three got much more interesting. And then as we get into part four, the final part, even though there's a lot of this that is, you know, tape plot-wise is taped together with masking tape, the aliens are not actually just pure evil. And they have a rationale. Jude has a rationale. He cares about his brother. Now, when his brother dies, he goes supervillain nuts. But prior to that point, he's actually a semi-rational being, and the doctor's able to work with him to a certain degree, and I like that. So even though I really hate the setup for the story, it has some redeeming elements in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to talk more about the setting and the era of that, because it's really key. Because if it was set contemporary, this came out in 2003. If it was set in 2003, that wouldn't have worked because of what was going on in 2003. So it's kind of interesting. So just to give my impression of this one, I did notice that this was much more mature in content than broadcast. Mm-hmm. A lot of direct references to drugs and sex. And a
few cuss words.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a bit psychedelic at points too. Like, you know, when Katrina goes on her, you know, angel dust trip, it's kind of wacky and stuff. Yeah. So it's kind of mature.
Yeah, and by angel dust we mean the drug PCP.
Yep.
Right.
So there are actual drug trips in this. I meant to mention about that. So when Doctor Who went off the air in the late 1980s, it was continued. The only regular new Doctor Who content that people had for a long time was the New Adventures novels. And the New Adventures novels decided, let's get more adult. You know, let's include sex and things that weren't in, and drug use and things like that, that weren't in the TV show. Because now we're not on TV. We don't have to please a family-friendly audience. So the novels, which I've never really read, but I happen to know the novels started including a lot more adult content. And this is one of the very first big finishes. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of influenced by the direction of the novels in including more of this adult content. But eventually Big Finish realizes what its mission needs to be is not a continuation of the novels, but a continuation of the TV show. Mm-hmm. And they end up taking that more adult content out of the Big Finish in order to make it more like the TV show.
Which is good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I will say that psychedelic scene, that's the one I was talking about where mm-hmm. it was almost physically painful in my, you know, in my headphones, because it was just bouncing around. You know, they played with the left and right channels and all that kind of stuff. And it was, you know, so many layers of voices and everything overlapping it. So that's kind of a warning, if you've got sensitive ears, that would be a scene that when you come to kind of pull the headphones away a little bit, so it's not quite so direct.
Yeah. That's a good point.
Yeah. I didn't use headphones and I found it a little muddled, but not painful.
Yeah.
I end up using an app called Mac Whisper, and I download the audio files, and I pull out an AI-based transcript of what's going on so I can read. Sometimes it's hard to understand, so I read along with it, which is interesting experience.
The fact we're Americans doesn't help. I was we just had an episode of Mysterious World about pet telepathy. And it focused in part on a parrot named Nkisi that would apparently repeat a thing or describe things that the owner was looking at in another room. So Nkisi could not see what the owner was looking at, but was nevertheless remarkably describing what the owner's looking at. And some footage of these experiments was played at a conference in America by the British researcher Rupert Sheldrake. And Rupert Sheldrake is, as I said, British. And so he was explaining to the American audience, now in this clip we're going to see, there will be subtitles to help understand what the parrot is saying. You probably don't need the subtitles, but this was originally meant for a British audience, which gets a huge laugh from the crowd. And then he says, because the parrot has an American accent.
Right. That's funny.
And so we have the reverse. You know, being Americans, we've got American accents, and it's a little harder, especially if the sound isn't perfect, or if you got people talking over each other, or if they're applying some kind of effect, it can be harder to understand the British accents. Mm-hmm.
That reminds me, I saw an announcement over the weekend that the BBC is uploading to a site called BBC Writes, WRITES, 200 scripts from Doctor Who, both TV, but also other media, to this website so that you can read along to the stories. And I did see someone note that, oh, great, now I can finally understand what the 13th Doctor was saying all this time. there are other sites online that have done that already, the similar things. But I want to talk about this story because it's set in Ibiza, Spain. I'm not going to do the Castilian accent, sorry.
I looked up how to pronounce it, and there are several different ways. The way they do it in the tape or in the recording is Ibiza.
Yeah. So yeah, in lots of Spain, they have the S and Z sounds are done with a TH. So
they have a lisp.
Yes. There's the fascinating story behind it, but we probably shouldn't go into that too. But in anyways, Ibiza is known as for many decades as this European vacation spot. It's sort of the equivalent of Daytona Beach, I suppose.
Still is. Especially for people from England, because it's so close and it's so relatively cheap to fly there and everything. So it's even to this day, you can get cheap flights, I guess, between, the UK and Ibiza.
Yeah, and lots of Spain. That's southern Spain is a popular UK holiday destination, so it's set there. Which is an island off the coast of Spain in the Mediterranean. And I think there's some more I want to talk about the location because they bring up an interesting historical figure. We'll get to that. But I do want to mention this definitely includes Sylvester McCoy and Sophie Aldred as the Dr. Anne Ace, but we'll
slash
also known as Nick Shane. It does start with the other thing that Jimmy, you mentioned, which is that stylistic back and forth conversational style in part two. It also includes this radio broadcasts at different points, which was interesting. And they used to great effect in a later Seventh Doctor audio story that we've already talked about.
Live 36. It's live 30 something.
Yeah, I think it's live 37. But yeah, they use it to great effect there.
And that one's genius. That one is outstanding.
Yeah.
Here, though, they do have something interesting about, at least if you're British, about the radio broadcast, which is they actually have a famous radio presenter named Tony Blackburn playing himself. And who hosts the radio segment. So he's the one talking about all the hot new stuff going on down at the Rapture and stuff. Mm-hmm. And he's an actual famous radio presenter in Britain.
Yep.
So let's talk about the Rapture as a theological concept, because so much of the story hangs on it. But so, Jimmy, what is the Rapture?
Well, it's a term that's used in a certain segment of Protestant Christianity. This is a very recent origin. People started to use this term around like the late 1820s. So this is actually only a couple hundred years old, and it's not used in either the more historic branches of Christianity like Catholicism and Orthodoxy, or even the more historic parts of Protestantism, which goes back about 500 years. It's based on a text in 1 Thessalonians. The text is 1 Thessalonians 4:17, and everybody agrees about the text. Nobody has a problem there. What the text says is that when Jesus returns, the dead will rise first, and then the faithful will be caught up into the air to be with Jesus forever. And the question is, when does this occur and what happens next? The historic Christian understanding of it, including Catholics, Orthodox, and most Protestants historically, is that this is the equivalent of a custom they had in the ancient world, where if you have a king who's going to come visit your city, you don't wait until he gets to the gates to greet him. You go out and meet him, and then you escort him back down or back into the city. And so the historic understanding has been that that's basically what's going on here. When Jesus returns at the end of the world, his followers, the faithful, both dead and alive, will go greet him and then escort him back down to the world where he will rule forever and will have the resurrection of the dead and the last judgment and the eternal order. But in the early 1800s to mid 1800s, a school developed in a group of Protestant Christians known as the Plymouth Brethren in England, who believed that instead what would happen is Jesus would return, but not actually come to earth. He'd return and get as far as the atmosphere. Then all these Christians would be caught up to be with him. That's what the rapture is. Rapture means to catch away. So all these Christians would be caught away. And then he would go back to heaven and take them all with him. And while he's in heaven for a period of maybe 7 years, the Antichrist and all hell is breaking loose on earth. And then Jesus comes back and reigns on earth for 1,000 years. And then the forces of evil get unleashed again. And then we have the final judgment and the resurrection of the dead. And so this system came to be known as dispensational premillennialism, and it became popular in the 20th century, particularly in America. And by the end of the 20th century, it went through some cycles of popularity, but by the end of the 20th century, we had these Tim LaHaye, Jerry Jenkins books based on this idea called the Left Behind series, where they basically take the dispensational premillennialism rapture theory and make a set of novels out of it. And these were extraordinarily popular at the time. And so a lot of people, including the author of this script, took that as just being, oh, that's what the Bible says. And so we get the doctor essentially saying at one point, the Bible says that the rapture is this event where Christ is going to catch away his followers, and then there's going to be this all hell breaks loose on earth period, and while they're all up in heaven. And it's like, okay, the Bible doesn't say that. That's dispensational premillennialism. Mm-hmm. If you actually read 1 Thessalonians, where it's talking about is the end of the world. It's not talking about more than 1,000 years before the end of the world.
And, a lot of Catholics have the mistaken understanding that this is part of Catholic teaching. It's not.
Yeah.
Well, and a lot of what Jimmy described, too, is events that are described in the book of Revelation, which, of course, has many layers upon layers upon layers of meaning. I mean, we could do hours of podcasts just talking about the book of Revelation alone. Yeah. But they take events in the book of Revelation and say, see, this is the map of what's going to happen when, you know, the 1,000 years and the 7 years and Jesus doing this and this happening. That all comes from book of Revelation. But it's again, it's all a misunderstanding of the book of Revelation.
It comes from the dispensational premillennial futurist understanding of the book of Revelation. There's a very good case that actually most of the book of Revelation is not in our future. It's in our past.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Exactly. One thing, too, I just mentioned quickly, you know, Jimmy mentioned about going to meet the king. Well, that, you know, when you think about the story of the prodigal son, where the son's coming and the father runs out to meet him. That's like an opposite of that. That's the king coming to the son. But of course, that shows God coming to us for forgiveness and love and welcoming.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. And I want to say something about angels, too, which is that angels are spirits. They do not have bodies. They can sometimes act. God allows them to act as, you know, in the world as if they have bodies at times. We see that in scripture. But
And according to the medievals, like Thomas Aquinas, they can make temporary bodies for themselves.
Right, right. Yeah. So now it becomes clear through the course of this story that while Jude thinks he's, or Gabriel thinks he's an angel, I keep mixing them up. That's because of his mental illness. But they're pretending. They're just aliens, as Jimmy mentioned.
Jude flat out mentions that we're not angels, and he says his brother believes it because he's mentally ill, and he says they're actually from something called the Euphorian Empire in another dimension, which, despite being an empire, isn't very imperial because they're so peaceful.
Right, right. It's hard to become an empire when you're full of peace. All right, so let's talk about Ace at the beginning of this. She's apparently been traveling with the doctor 10 years at this point, she mentions. And she's insisting on being called McShane, that's her last name, Dorothy McShane, instead of Ace.
Dorothy Gale McShane, after Dorothy Gale from The Wizard of Oz.
Right. Hmm. And I think maybe that part of that is because they're emphasizing she's an adult now, she's not the teenager. Of that period, and, you know, she's going to nightclubs and drinking beer
there were some tragedies, you know. There's a whole scene in here where they talks about her, about death, you know, how, okay, yeah, they go in, they, you know, a couple of people die, but they solve the problem and they move on, and then there was one or two deaths that just really hit her hard. That's why she's trying to get away from the Ace persona and moving to more mature McShane.
So this is set between Survival, the final Sylvester McCoy TV episode, and the 1996 movie. And because of how much discussion there was of recent events, I tried to look up and find, so were these earlier Big Finish stories? And I couldn't really find them. But apparently, this is shortly on the heels of an adventure where Ace saw death again, as she has before, but it wasn't, it was more dramatic because somebody they had taken, someone had died on the TARDIS in this adventure. And that was what made it all the more impactful for Ace, because to her, psychologically, the TARDIS had always been this place of safety where, yeah, they would encounter danger when they went places, but then they could retreat to the TARDIS and it would be a place of safety. And here, death invaded the TARDIS and killed somebody in front of Ace. And so suddenly, the TARDIS is not this safe place anymore, and it's messing with her psychologically. And she's going through a bit of an existential crisis right now, and that's part of why she wants to be called McShane instead of Ace.
Well, and then they also mention Kara from the final TV show series, Survival, was the Catwoman who died when Ace was there with her.
Yeah.
So that, it, I mean, it goes all the way back to there, but this is where it becomes the most real.
So, and she'd asked the Doctor to take her back to London, because she wants to take a break. She's up angry. She's upset. She needs a break from traveling and danger and weird stuff. And she'd asked him to take her back to London, but he took to her to Ibiza instead because it's a place of peace. And I'm like, party towns don't seem like much of a place of peace, I think. I mean, it's kind of weird that the Doctor thinks what she needs is to go out and party and dance and, you know, go to clubs and drink and hook up or whatever. It just seems kind of weird.
Also, I kind of, part of, I mean, I agree with what you just said, but also one of the things I like here is he is treating her as an adult. Mm-hmm. You know, she's a young adult, but she is an adult. She's not just the teenage kid anymore. And he wants her to be able to hang out with young people her own age and have that as a more normal experience. And Ibiza is the kind of place that young people her own age go.
And okay. Well, let's also be honest. It's a very strong trope within Doctor Who. Oh, we're going to go to this resort place, and it turns out to be a disaster. Or we're going to go end up here, and instead the TARDIS redirects them somewhere else. So, I mean, this is a trope within Doctor Who anyway. So you got to have it.
So when they get there, they encounter they go to this beachside bar, which I do like the fact it's very evocative. I kind of would like to be there right now. It's February as we're recording. I kind of like to be there right now. But they go to
sitting under an umbrella, drinking a pina colada.
and they encounter this fellow named Gustavo, a bartender there, who the Doctor knows from the past, because apparently the Doctor had been somehow involved with the Spanish Civil War. You know, the fighting there.
Of some and sort. Gustavo fought in the Spanish Civil War back in like the 1930s.
Right. And that comes up again later on because, you know, we hear mention of Francisco Franco, who's still dead, by the way. And sorry, that's a
Saturday Night Live joke.
Yeah. And Gustavo is not just a bystander. He's actually a key component of this. He's the one who kind of sets up the Angel Brothers to do what they do, because he's the one who diagnoses the young people of this era as having, you know, they're looking for a music to help feel emotion, to make them forget their problems. He says, the children who come here are out of control, Doctor. They no longer have beliefs or anything to fight for. I ache for the days when they understood what it was all about, when they treasured life, which is a very interesting positive perspective in one sense, which gets enacted in a bad way.
Yeah. So he provided funding, the startup money for the Raptured nightclub, we eventually learn. And so he's kind of he's the silent partner in the nightclub. Yeah. But what he didn't know is that the aliens were going to mind control people to recruit them to their war effort. He thought it was going to be like the 1930s where, you know, Spanish, you know, partisans got recruited voluntarily to fight. Yep. And he didn't realize the aliens were going to be using music to hypnotize people.
Right. And so
and drugs.
Right. And yes, that's the angel dust part of it. Mm-hmm. So I said we'd mention, you know, the era, the context of the time. So it's 1997. You know, the Cold War had ended in the early 90s. the war on terror and, you know, those terrorist attacks wouldn't be for 4 more years. I mean, 97 mm-hmm. was a time where people were seriously talking about the end of history. It's kind of funny to look back at that naivete now. But, you know, where there would be no more wars and, you know, no more of that to have to worry about. And
no so more I could, big ones.
Right. Yeah. And I could see where people would, you know, it's interesting that then this was written in 2000 or produced in 2003. After that, you know, fantasy mm-hmm. had been disproved. But we do see this often nowadays, don't we? This trope that, oh, this young generation, they're not as good as the previous generation because they don't mm-hmm. have the struggles that they had. We heard this said about millennials. We heard this said about Gen Z. You know, it's just seems to be a trope.
Part of it is due to a kind of I forget the exact term for it, but there is a persistent cognitive bias that humans have that says that the past was better than the present. Mm-hmm. And there is a persistent romanticization of the past. This is not a new thing. I mean, you go back and you read, you know, Plato and Aristotle and works of literature from that era, and they're talking about how the youth have run down mm-hmm. since their parents' day. And so there is this romanticization of the past that has to be taken into account that is not an accurate reflection of things. Actually, history has gotten a lot better. There's a book by the he's actually an atheist, but by the cognitive scientist, linguist Steven Pinker called The Better Angels of Our Nature, where he looks at like your chance of dying from violence mm-hmm. across millennial scales and the scale of centuries and the scale of decades. And by every measure, your chance of dying by violence has been going down dramatically. Mm-hmm. Yep. And so in a lot of ways, and people are vastly more prosperous now than they were in the past. And so, I mean, an ordinary person lives like kings and queens would have lived in the past mm-hmm. or even better. And so actually a lot of things in the world are getting much better. But at the same time, I think that there is an element of critique that's legitimate here where because of the reduction of faith and because of the pacification of Europe, there are a lot of young people who are disconnected from mm-hmm. the realities of life. And frankly, I can't watch a lot of British television. And this is not just Britain and not just mm-hmm. Europe. It's also America, though to a lesser degree. But I can't watch a lot of contemporary British TV because of how soulless it is. Mm-hmm. And by that, I don't mean non-religious. I just mean it's bleak and despairing and depressing. And there's no fundamental moral structure to the universe in some of these TV shows. So anyway, I think there is an element of truth here, despite the fact that we also have a cognitive bias that's at play.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'd throw in addition some of the worst elements of the internet. You know, there's a reason why the mm-hmm. meme go touch grass is a thing, mm-hmm. you know, because there are people who they get caught up in the internet world and the internet drama and the internet ideas and everything. And they lose sight of what's outside their doors, even if they are going out and going to work or whatever. You know, and that definitely plays a big part, I would argue, especially in recent years. Mm.
By the way, I think that the generation they're talking about is actually Gen X, which is, mm-hmm. You know, I think
Jimmy, kind of tail end of Gen X, beginning of millennial.
Yeah, I think it's tail end Gen X because this is 97. They're in their 20s, college age. That's definitely tail end Gen X.
We were in our 20s. I was 20 in 97, so.
Yeah, Jimmy, I think
was
you
32.
Might be a late, you're a late boomer.
I am.
Yeah, so that my brother is the same, but yeah, we're the it's funny now to look back because Gen X, we think we're the hot stuff now.
Well, we are, but I mean that's beside the point. Yeah.
So let's talk about Liam. This happens to be Ace's. I'm going to just call her Ace because it's she'll always be Ace to me. Yeah. Ace's long lost, long unknown, heretofore unknown brother, who. Mm-hmm. For some reason, is carrying around a photo of Ace. Well, not for some reason. They explain it. But he's got this photo of Ace in his wallet and recognizes her on sight somehow. I'm not sure.
Well, he's got this photo. He's been looking at this photo for years, and then he sees her, and she's only 10 years older, you know. Okay. So the difference between a 17-year-old and a 27-year-old, you can still recognize him.
That's true. So he recognizes
and works better with women than men because the man might have grown a beard, but
gone bald and all that. Yeah. And so it's interesting that it's pure coincidence, right? I mean, is there, or are we to believe that there's some other force that has brought them together?
No, it's coincidence. They make it clear that you can understand, like, if he's looking for her, if he's trying to find her, he's going to be looking around. He goes into a room like this. He goes to a place like a bar, goes to a store, he's going to be looking around. He's going to be just seeing as any, and just because he kind of, I think he even says something like, I can't believe it. It's her.
Right.
Kind of like, I go on this holiday, this vacation, and there she is. Yeah. I've been looking for her for a year or more,
And Liam doesn't know, Ace doesn't know about Liam. He was born like 4 years after she was, and she hasn't seen him since she was like four, so she doesn't remember him. What happened was her mom had an affair, and her dad picked up Liam and left, and wasn't able to get Ace because she was like at daycare or something. Right. Mm. And so Ace only would have, childhood amnesia, which sets in between ages 5 and 8, and blocks out our memories from age 5 and before. Well, she lost her brother at age 4. So that got blocked out. She doesn't remember him.
And her brother was just an infant. I mean, he was still in the, literally just pulled him out of the crib and left.
And then Liam's got this friend, Katrina, and this other friend, Brian, who dies early.
Really early.
Poor Brian. He seemed like a nice guy.
Yeah. I mean, Gabriel just kills him.
Yeah.
Because he wasn't drinking or anything like that. And that's part of get the whole effect of the rapture.
Right.
You had to be drinking because it sounds like they laced all the alcohol and all that kind of stuff. But but he was just drinking water. Just straight water. Mm-hmm. So everybody else was going into the trance, and he was, going on? There's something wrong here.
And it was kind of fascinating. Gabriel is playing the music and he's talking to the crowd, and they've got this sunset over this island that they're watching at the same time. And he's quoting scripture, and it's kind of fascinating to contrast the holiness of scripture and the hedonism of the nightclub. You get this, these things smashing together, and they just don't fit.
Yeah. I think this is at part one where this is happening is I think the weakest of all the parts, because this imagery just does not fit.
Right.
And it's meant to be creepy, but it ends up being lame.
And then you have this other friend, Katrina, as I mentioned, and
she is manic depressive.
Right. Oh, yeah. The illegal pharmacology is probably not helping with her.
Mm-hmm. No.
Her depression. And they kind of make depression sound like mood swings. Depression's a real illness, and people.
But it is part of the manic depressive cycle. She is they later actually use the term manic depressive for her. Today it would be called bipolar, but she goes through euphoric manic cycles, and she goes through depressive angry cycles, and sometimes she flips on a dime.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And Gabriel is sort of almost takes advantage of that, and meets her on the beach and gives her some of the PCP and takes her on a trip, where she's flying and she's ascending and becoming a god. This was, as Father Corey, you mentioned, this was the weirdest part of it. And I think the least enjoyable, because it was so weird.
It's the end of episode 2. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you hear different voices, like you hear Ace's voice. And at one point she's berating her, and Liam and Ace are fighting. And another point they're both praising her, how great she is. And, first, it's like, okay, is this something she's actually, like having some telepathic connection?
Yeah.
But this is all in her head. This is all just voices. Your doctor comes in at some point as the Sandman. And
so then you have at the end, is it Jude or Gabriel is trying to get her to kill Ace and Liam. her
That's
friends.
Jude.
Okay. I couldn't remember which one exactly. And she ends up, because he thinks that he's got her under his control, but she ends up turning the weapon on herself. They think she's dead, but she's actually, the weapon was depleted. So
and the doctor points out that she had depleted it, knowing she might be asked to kill her friend. So right. So she was, that was an expression of her fundamental goodness.
Right.
And so when she was ordered to kill him and she turned the weapon on herself, she only injured herself. And when they are explaining this to her after she's better, it's like, oh, phaser's on stun.
Mm-hmm. Yes. That's
yeah. Well, and then that's what it was. You know, they said a gun, yeah. But it was, you know, a phaser or some kind of energy weapon. Just stunned her.
Does she go with Ace and the doctor in the TARDIS at the end?
Mm-mm.
Oh,
she and Liam stay behind on Ibiza. The doctor and Ace go off.
Okay. It kind of sounded like she was going with them, so I wasn't sure on that. So they mention this island that you can see from the club that the sun sets over called Esvedra. And they mentioned that there was this monk, Francisco Palau. Well, he was a real person. He is Blessed Francisco Palau, a Discalced Carmelite priest. He was, this is a Wikipedia article on him, in fact. You can go read about him. He was exiled to Ibiza at one point and founded a hermitage there. There is no mention that I could find of him having apparitions, visions. Mm-hmm. But they talk
Wouldn't
about
be
him
surprising.
Having. Yeah. Would you say would be surprising?
Would not be surprising.
Oh, right. Yeah. But in this, they claim that he had a vision on that island, and that's why he's blessed. And that the vision was, in fact, Gabriel and Jude communicating with him through the interdimensional portal from beyond. So it wasn't God talking to Blessed Francisco, which
it's annoying. It's like, don't mess with people's sacred beliefs and just turn them into aliens. It's one thing. It's one thing if you're doing it in Stargate, where no one worships these gods anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's another thing if you're doing it with a live religion.
Which, yeah. By the way, speaking of Stargate, I, as a panelist on The Secrets of Stargate, I have to correct. The Stargate is not an interdimensional portal. It is a wormhole through subspace that goes from planet to planet in this dimension.
In this dimension. That's yeah. Right.
They do refer to the movie Stargate in this. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, they do. But I kind of wish they had just made up a new person instead of using a real person in Francisco Palau. That would have been you know, better than what they ended up doing. I don't think that's right to do that. Like you said, mess with people's religion.
They don't have any qualms in that, though. I mean, these are most likely either non-believers of any kind or, you know, actual atheists who are fighting against, you know, perhaps Christian beliefs. You know, so they don't have any qualms that they're abusing someone's religious beliefs,
perhaps. Yeah. And in the end, it turns out that, as you mentioned, Jimmy, they're interdimensional travelers. Jude is insane, and then his death.
Gabriel.
Both of them are.
Both of them are. So Gabriel's insane first, and Gustavo ends up killing Gabriel to stop them after he realizes what's going on, and that's what sets off Jude to make him.
Gustavo insane. Also dies in that process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Not everybody dies in this one, but a lot of people do. But it's interesting the doctor's compassion toward Jude at the end, where he wants to, you know, he compassionately asks him to save Ace. He's threatening Ace's life by holding her over a drop, which I'm not sure it was that
this
far.
This is 15 feet.
Yeah, you might get a nasty break in the. But
you can survive a 15-foot drop.
Yeah, I've done so. And then but he, you know, pull in Ace, save her, and come with me. I'll help you find a new life, away from the war that you were escaping. So it's interesting, compassionate response from the doctor. But then Jude actually himself, he wants to go back home to face the consequences of, you know, what's going on where he's from.
Or so he says. But and the doctor actually, he lets him go. And actually, he sneaks away.
Yeah,
and they're talking to the doctor about it. And the doctor is assuring them, "Oh, I think we've seen the last of him for reasons X, Y, and Z." And the doctor's wrong, because if you listen to the credits at the end, after the Doctor Who theme plays, we get a clip of a couple of women in London talking, and one of them has just gotten a a voicemail or an email that has an attachment and says, I love you. I've written this song for you. And she starts playing it, and chaos starts erupting. And so we know it's Jude has continued his destructive quest.
Right.
Oh, by the way, another problem with this is the music. Everyone, especially in part one, where the music is more in the focus, everyone's just, oh, this is so great. This is the best music ever, you know, like in human history. And that's always a risk. That's always a problem writing wise, because you can say it's the best music in history, but your low budget sound designer who's not gonna be able to produce the best music in history. This is not gonna be the Hallelujah Chorus. It's gonna sound pretty generic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Although you could maybe headcanon it as it's the influence of the drugs and the whatever.
Right. I know I could, but it doesn't live up to the billing.
It does not.
And you're assuming too, Jimmy, that this was even done by a sound designer, that it wasn't just like stock audio like you can get for your podcast or whatever.
Dance music. All right. Anything left to say about the rapture, Father Corey?
Nothing here.
How about you, Jimmy?
A couple things. I'll have a criticism and a praise. The criticism is the cliffhangers are weak in this. At the end of part one, the Doctor has gone to find Ace in the club, and she is a screaming zombie at this point. She's yelling, you know, behold the rapture and stuff like that. And this is our dramatic out. Ace is like zombified now. And then beginning of part two, she's totally not stoned. She's just instantly normal again. It's like, what's the matter with you, Doctor? Why are you so concerned?
Right.
And that's a cheap way out of the danger you just set up. They do something similar at the end of part two. At the end of part two, we hear Tony Blackburn kind of hosting this, you know, drugged out trip that Kat is having. And he's hinting, he says a couple of times, and we'll be back in just a moment for my final thought, which will probably also be her final thought too. So we're, you know, it's sinister. And then when we get into the beginning of part three, we're still in the drug trip. And now for my final thought, my mind's gone blank. And it's like, okay, that's a cheap way out of the danger you just set up. You know, hinting there's going to be this sinister final thought and then your mind just goes blank. So that's criticism. Here's a praise. There is a nice bit it's either in part three or the beginning of part four, where you have the Doctor and Ace meeting Jude. And the Doctor is not sure. He's just meeting him. He's not sure what Jude's name is. And he approaches Jude as he's starting to talk to him and says, Mr. And Jude says, just Jude. Mr. Just Doctor. And this is just McShane. And you have this nice little bit with the voices of Jude and the Doctor and Ace.
Yeah, that was good. I did notice that. That was good. Excellent. All right. So that's the rapture. And so let's move on to our feedback that I mentioned before. This first feedback comes from our episode where we discussed the big finish story, Precious Annihilation, featuring River Song and the 10th Doctor.
That was the Explodey Jewels episode.
Yes. The Explodey Jewels that were in a place called Cheapside in London, which we wondered about. And Tammy LML on YouTube writes that Cheapside is absolutely a real place in London. So,
I looked it up later, and it's about a half a mile from St. Paul's Cathedral. It's actually a fairly prominent part of London today. Back at the time that this was set, it was the cheap part of London.
Okay.
As I understand it.
And then on our episode on the First Doctor story, The Mythmakers, the Cloister Bell writes on YouTube, "Hello, gentlemen, Stotzi here. Thank you very much for the shout-out. Great video. I do love the historical stories of the early years. Always a lot of fun. In response to the McGann comments, I absolutely love the Eighth Doctor Big Finish stories. Mm-hmm. Not only was his presence on screen brilliant and memorable, but he shines through on audio perfectly. Cheers, guys. I look forward to the next one."
Yeah, I really like Paul McGann's stuff, and his Big Finish stuff. I'm glad they gave us an on-screen in Night of the Doctor. They gave mm-hmm. us an on-screen canonization of that material. And I'd love to see him get a spinoff series, which Russell T. Davies has indicated he's open to doing spinoff series with past Doctors. They should give one to Paul McGann.
Oh, he would absolutely be fantastic in that.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, as listeners know, we've been doing the Eighth Doctor stories, Big Finish stories here, and yeah, it's fun. I would love to see that translated to the screen.
That was something else I was going to mention about the Rapture. Is it's not to my mind, it's not a great Big Finish story. There are some that are brilliant, like Live 36 or whatever its number is, and The Chimes at Midnight, which is an Eighth Doctor story with Charlie. Mm-hmm. And those are brilliant. Those are awesome. Yep. This is in the lower half.
Right.
And by the way, you could go back through our archives and you can hear our conversations on both of those.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep.
We've talked about both of them.
And we'll be doing talking about the Eighth Doctor again in 2 weeks when we do another one of his called Scherzo.
Scherzo. Yeah. Which also is highly regarded.
Oh, good. All right. Well, thank you both for your feedback. We really do appreciate it. And now we'd like to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create the Secrets of Doctor Who, including Russell T., not Davies, Joe S.,
Darn.
Stephen B., Charlene C., and Charles M. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue The Secrets of Doctor Who and all the shows at StarQuest, and you can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. And we'd also like to thank Simon Yannick, who edited this episode. So that's it from us. What did you think of this Seventh Doctor Big Finish audio story, The Rapture? You can let us know by commenting on the show at sqpn.com or the Secrets of Doctor Who Facebook page, or send an email to doctorwho@sqpn.com, or visit the StarQuest Discord community at sqpn.com/discord. And you can watch the Secrets of Doctor Who on our YouTube channel, where we are at youtube.com/StarQuestMedia. We'll be back next time, and we'll be discussing the Ninth Doctor Big Finish story, The Butler Did It. Spoilers. Until then, Father Corey Stika, thank you for joining me and sharing the Secrets of Doctor Who. Jimmy Akin, thank you as well.
Thank you, and just for closure, it's Live 34. I should have averaged my guesses of 32 and 36.
There you go. And once again, I'm Dom Bettinelli. Thank you for listening to The Secrets of Doctor Who on StarQuest. And remember, I must be a Christian sci-fi Muppet.